hipsters are facing is uncertainty.
What happens if Doge cancels tens of billions of dollars that the Department of Agriculture was sending to farmers and ranchers?
It's Thursday, July 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, the whole world has been caught up in President Trump's on-again, off-again trade war.
But Brazil could present a unique situation.
Brazil may prove quite willing to escalate in a different way than what Trump has envisioned from any other trade partner.
Also, some of our favorite stories from the week in science.
Including a worm that could solve some of our plastic problems.
It takes about 2,000 or so waxworms to fully consume a plastic bag in about 24 hours.
And we will remember composer Mark Snow, who wrote theme music for TV shows like The X-Files.
The news is out there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A federal judge in New Hampshire has blocked the enforcement of President Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. NPR's Juliana Kim reports the decision is the latest setback in Trump's effort to end automatic citizenship to people born in the U.S.
The ruling stems from a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union and other advocacy groups. That suit was filed last month, just hours after the Supreme Court's decision to limit nationwide injunctions. Despite the Supreme Court's ruling, class action lawsuits can still block the president's policies across large sections of the country. So on Thursday, the groups asked the court to certify their case as a class action and to issue a preliminary injunction against Trump's executive order. The judge granted both. The judge also stayed his order for 7 days in order to give the federal government a chance to appeal. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
The death toll continues to rise in central Texas nearly a week after catastrophic flooding swept through the region. State officials say at least 120 people are confirmed dead, with more than 170 still missing. Lawmakers will return to the Capitol next week for a special session to address flood warning systems, emergency communications, and disaster relief funding. Sergeant Jonathan Lamb is with the Kerrville Police Department. He says local officials are encouraged by the state's response.
The governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker of the house are strongly committed to helping our community. And we're grateful that they're making our recovery a priority in the upcoming special legislative session.
President Trump and the First Lady are scheduled to visit Central Texas tomorrow. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is planning to fire hundreds of employees as part of a State Department redesign. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the Supreme Court paved the way for the reduction in forces expected on Friday.
Speaking to reporters on a trip to Malaysia, Secretary Rubio said he was proud of the way his department has planned a 15% reduction of workers.
We went very specifically through and reorganized the State Department. And when you reorganize the State Department, there were certain bureaus we wanted to empower the regional bureaus, and there were certain bureaus, these functional bureaus, that were closed.
He's closed 132 offices and rewrote the rules to be able to fire people who worked in them. Former diplomats of the American Academy of Diplomacy call it an act of vandalism and bad management of what they describe as an important resource, America's national security professionals. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Stocks traded higher today on Wall Street. The Dow was up 192 points. The Nasdaq Composite was up 19. This is NPR News. One of the world's most famous handbags made history today. The original Birkin bag was auctioned off at Sotheby's in Paris for more than $10 million. The bag was sketched by fashion icon Jane Birkin in 1984 on an airplane sick bag and later crafted by high-end retailer Hermes. Delta Airlines is expecting a strong outlook for summer travel as demand stabilizes. Marlon Hyde from member station WABE reports the Atlanta-based company posted revenue of $15.5 billion for the June quarter.
Delta Airlines says its growth was pushed by its credit card program, international travel picking up, and increased sales of premium-priced tickets. The company restored its 2025 outlook. Earlier this year, Delta Airlines did not provide a full-year outlook for 2025, citing economic uncertainty. Ed Bastian is the company's CEO.
With continued progress on trade negotiations, we expect both consumer and corporate confidence to improve in the second half of the year, creating the environment for travel demand to accelerate.
Delta expects revenue to grow up to 4% by the end of the September fiscal quarter. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
Thailand's most famous hippopotamus just turned one. Mudang, a baby pygmy hippo, is marking her first birthday with a four-day celebration complete with a giant fruit and veggie cake and fan meetups. The baby hippo went viral last year, boosting zoo attendance and even inspiring a multilingual song. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. A lot has changed in the past year. The speed limit has not. Speeders can expect to be stopped. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. Looking at weather tonight, increasing clouds, temps in the low to mid-60s, chance for showers and thunderstorms after midnight.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Billionaire CEO Elon Musk isn't hanging out in Washington as much anymore, due in part to major policy disagreements and online feuds with President Trump, as well as ongoing challenges managing his companies. But one of his major pet projects, the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, lives on. At the U.S. Department of Agriculture, one DOGE staffer can now review and cancel tens of billions of dollars in government loans and payments to American farmers and ranchers. This is a group that makes up a big chunk of Trump's political base. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin has that exclusive reporting and joins us now. Hey, Jenna.
Hey, Scott.
So DOGE has not been in the headlines quite as much since Musk left the government. Catch us up on the status of this special government team.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a busy news cycle, but even without Musk in D.C., DOGE has continued to find ways to burrow their way into these federal agencies. NPR put together a team to cover the federal restructuring and what DOGE has been up to. Back in February, we've been busy keeping track of everything that they've got going on. I've had a particular focus on DOGE's access to sensitive data, and that's how I started looking at the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, so what did you hear about what is happening at the Department of Agriculture?
Yeah, so I got to look at internal access logs that show that Jordan Wick, a former software engineer who used to work at Waymo, who's been publicly linked to DOGE, got high-level access to this government system, the one that controls tens of billions of dollars in subsidies and loans for millions of American farmers and ranchers. It lives inside part of the USDA called the Farm Service Agency. Think of it kind of like the agency's bank. Loans are a big part of what they do, but they also distribute subsidies for things like disaster relief. Think major storms or the COVID-19 pandemic.
Okay, so he's in that system. What exactly can he and DOGE do with that access?
A lot. First of all, he can see all that sensitive personal information. I mean, think about the kind of things that you have to send to the bank to apply for a loan. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they know me better than my family after buying a house.
Right.
It's also possible that there could be demographic information like race in parts of that database. Advocates are worried that that data could be abused, but it's even more than that.
Like what?
Well, with this kind of access, Wick can write onto the system. And what that means is that he can change entries, cancel loans or payments. And that's in line with a memo I saw that went out to USDA staffers announcing that DOGE would be reviewing a big chunk of farm loans going forward. No other individual at the agency has this access. That's part of why the source who provided this information and some of the others I spoke to asked to be anonymous. They were worried about retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
When DOGE has gotten similar levels of access to databases at the Social Security Administration and the Treasury Department, it's been challenged in the courts. We did eventually hear back from a USDA spokesperson after publication. They confirmed that the USDA efficiency team, including WIC, are full-time USDA employees and that they're working to fulfill President Trump's executive order to hunt for fraud and what they described as national security concerns, though they didn't really explain what that meant.
Okay, so here's an important question. Did you find any farmers who have had their loans canceled or changed because of this access?
Not yet. And it turns out that might be a really hard question to answer. I spoke to Scott Marlowe. He ran FSA programs under President Biden. He said some payments are seasonal. Farmers might not know right away if payments disappear, for example. He says he's telling farmers and ranchers he works with to keep a close eye on their loan terms, print out their files, make a list, and check it twice. Scott will also point out that my source says it would be hard for senior officials to monitor what DOGE is up to inside the system because there aren't really safeguards or alerts for unusual activity when you have that level of access.
Mm-hmm.
Marlowe tells me he would be concerned about anyone having that much access to USDA systems without oversight. Take a listen.
That ability to change without fingerprints is extremely troublesome in any, I don't care who it is, in any system.
So that's the reaction on the expert level, the Washington level. What about farmers and ranchers who might be more directly affected by this?
Yeah, it's hard to be a farmer right now in general. They're distracted by tariffs, cuts to government programs, not to mention increasingly common natural disasters. I mean, just look at this awful flooding we're seeing in Texas and New Mexico. But specifically related to this, I spoke to Zach Duchenal. He's the former head of the Farm Service Agency under President Biden. But he's also a rancher from South Dakota. His family has had a ranch on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation for decades. He says farmers and ranchers are facing the fear of uncertainty, having inexperienced people come in and hold up or threaten farmers' loans. He's worried that that will only make that uncertainty worse.
That is NPR's Jenna McLaughlin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brazil's president says the U.S. must respect his country. And if President Trump's threat of a 50% tax on Brazilian goods goes into effect in August, he's ready to reciprocate with his own tariff. Trump sent a letter to the Brazilian leader saying he plans to impose the hefty tariff, citing an ongoing legal case against Brazil's former president. From Rio de Janeiro, NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Speaking to a reporter this afternoon, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said at first when he saw the letter from President Trump posted on social media, he couldn't believe it. I thought the letter from the president was a fake, he told Record TV. In the interview posted on Lula's social media accounts, he goes on to say Trump got the Brazilian-U.S. trade relationship wrong. The U.S. enjoys a trade surplus with Brazil.
Primeiro, na questão da soberania do Brasil.
Most important, though, Lula says, is the question over Brazil's sovereignty. We want Trump to respect Brazil. Trump has sent multiple countries similar letters informing them the government will be imposing high tariffs unless their country negotiates a better deal with the U.S., citing unfair trade deficits. But the letter to Brazil focused more on domestic politics, specifically how it is treating its former president, Jair Bolsonaro. The ex-far-right leader is on trial for attempting to overturn his 2022 election loss and stay in power. Trump demanded the case be dropped immediately, calling Bolsonaro a highly respected world leader who is, quote, facing a witch hunt.
We've crossed a line.
Mark Bush, a political scientist and expert in trade policy at Georgetown University, says a U.S. president using economic policy to settle political scores is seriously provocative. Bush says Trump tried to slap tariffs on Colombia for not taking back deportees, but Brazil is a major U.S. trading partner, he says. It has a history of making its own trade threats and most likely won't fold as Colombia did.
Brazil taking them seriously may prove quite willing to escalate in a dramatic and qualitatively different way than what Trump has envisioned from any other trade partner.
President Lula says he will retaliate and is exploring options. His finance minister, Fernando Haddad, did try to lower the tone a bit in a different interview posted on his Instagram account.
Podem e devem ser superadas pela diplomacia brasileira.
This can and must be overcome by Brazilian diplomacy, which has always been available to the American government, says Haddad. But Trump's threat has many exporters here worried, like Glaucio de Castro, a coffee farmer in the agricultural powerhouse state of Minas Gerais. He also heads a large coffee federation there. Ironically, he and many members are more politically aligned with President Trump and the former Brazilian leader on trial.
Eu concordo com o pensamento I agree with Trump's thinking, but it's not right to affect our country commercially. It's really harmful to us, he says. Castro says he hopes cooler minds prevail and a deal is made. Brazil is the largest coffee producer in the world. Economists say such a steep tariff will result in higher coffee prices. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The composer Mark Snow has died. He did the music for many TV shows, including The X-Files. He was 78 years old. NPR's Andrew Limbong has this appreciation.
Today, we know the music of The X-Files, the sonic soundscape of the show, to be spooky and synthy. But it almost wasn't. The show's creator, Chris Carter, told NPR in 2016 that, at the onset of the show, he was pushing composer Mark Snow in a different direction.
Mark would send me things and I'd say, not quite. No, I don't think so. I said to him, you know, there's a song that I love. I just love these guitars. Listen to the song and see if it inspires something. And the song is by the Smiths called How Soon Is Now.
Obviously, this is not what the X-Files theme song sounds like, thanks to an accident. Mark Snow told NPR in 2016 that he happened to put his elbow on his keyboard, which happened to have a specific delay effect on it.
Which turned out to be the accompaniment figure in the theme that went da ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da da. I thought, well, that's a nice little accompaniment figure. What could be the other parts of it?
Then he stumbled across a whistling synthesizer sample and started tinkering with it.
My wife heard this and says, well, that's pretty interesting. What's that? And I said, well, I'm just fooling around with this new theme. She said, you know, I'm a good whistler, too. Maybe I could beef it up a little bit.
Snow didn't just do the X-Files theme music. He composed music for the show's entire run, including the movies and the show's comeback in 2016. He was born Martin Fulterman in Brooklyn, New York in 1946. He went to Juilliard, and there he formed a band called the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble.
Who is Lucy?
Eventually, he and his family moved to Los Angeles, where he started working in TV, including on the William Shatner cop show T.J. Hooker. After the initial success of The X-Files, Snow composed the music for other TV shows such as Smallville and Blue Bloods. But in that 2016 interview, Snow told NPR that working on other TV shows felt samey-samey in terms of creative opportunities. They were good gigs, sure, but working on The X-Files, he said, felt like magic. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. KAXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. Consider becoming a business or community sponsor to help KAXE build strong connections now and into the future. Text the word SPONSOR to 218-326-1234.
On today's date, July 10th, 1989, the common mullein began to bloom. Common mullein starts its life as a rosette, and it is a biennial plant, so the first year you have just leaves on the ground. The second year, a tall stalk emerges, and that stalk will begin to be the flowers that we are going to be seeing anytime soon. These yellow flowers arrange themselves on the top of this stalk in a sort of a circular pattern and bloom from the bottom going up. Mullein also is known as Quaker's Rouge. And Quaker's Rouge because the Quaker girls weren't allowed to use makeup. And so they would often take the leaves of the Quaker's Rouge, rub it on their cheeks, and the hairs from the leaf would irritate the skin enough to cause it to take on a blush. The American Indians used the tall stalk as a torch. They would take that stalk and dry it, and then they would roll it into pitch and ignite it, and it would sputter and burn and provide them with light through the night.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's time now for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined by the show's hosts, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hello, you two.
Hey, Ari.
Hi, Ari.
You have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
An interstellar visitor that's exciting astronomers.
Cool.
A plastic-eating worm that could revolutionize recycling.
Nice.
And why some animals' sense of smell varies by altitude.
I like this week's selection. Let's start with the interstellar visitor. Please tell me he has big eyes and a glowing finger.
I wish. No, it's a comet, and most comets orbit our sun. You know, they're bound by our solar system. But this one came in 137,000 miles per hour from another star. And it's incredibly rare to get visitors like this.
Yes, this comet's coming in hot. And astronomers spotted it. It's dubbed 3I Atlas on July 1st using the NASA-funded Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System, or ATLAS. This is a network of four telescopes, and the telescope in Chile caught this comet.
You both sound very blasé about this comet traveling 137,000 miles an hour that was caught by the last alert system. Should we be ducking for cover?
So, no, we should not be ducking for cover. There's nothing to fear. Astronomers are guessing it'll stay roughly like 150 million miles from Earth. That's about like 1.5 times the distance from Earth to the sun. So it's really far. Yeah. It will come kind of close to Mars, though.
Yeah, so no dinosaur fate for
us. Okay. You said these kinds of visitors are rare. How many have we seen before?
So this is only the third confirmed interstellar object to have zoomed past Earth. The first one was in 2017. You may remember Oumuamua, which means a messenger from afar arriving first in Hawaiian. Yeah, there was all this public controversy at the time that maybe it was a spaceship.
People continue to debate this today, right? We don't really know. And the fact that we only had 2 or 3 weeks to study that object should tell you something about why.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of astronomers don't think it's a spaceship, but we don't really know too much about it. That was planetary astronomer Teddy Carretta, who studies comets and the past interstellar objects. He says this comet 3I Atlas will be here for longer, though.
We haven't seen this object before. We'll have a couple of months to study it for real, and then it's gone forever.
Teddy says studying these objects can help answer this big question. Is our solar system unique or not? This comet most likely formed with planets around another faraway star, so studying it might tell us something about how other solar systems are made and how planets form there.
Cool. So scientists are going to have a couple months to study it. What about amateur astronomers? Will we be able to see it in the night sky?
Yes, Ari, you, our listeners, in October, when the comet gets closer to Earth, if you venture somewhere far, far away from city lights.
So under dark skies with a big telescope and some patience, maybe you might be able to see it. That might be the first time anyone has actually seen the light from an interstellar object with their own eyes.
That's so cool.
So come October, I'll be trying to spot it.
Sounds amazing. Okay, next up, plastic-eating worms. Where did they come from?
Yeah, they're called wax worms, and they're larvae of wax moths. And they're these little white caterpillars that chew through beeswax.
And more than a decade ago, this beekeeper in Europe, who happens to be a scientist, was cleaning out her beehives, and she put the wax worms in a plastic bag. And when she got home, she realized the worms had eaten through the bag all on their own.
What?
And this intrigues scientists like Brian Cassoni at Canada's Brandon University.
There wasn't anything known about how the waxworm is eating plastic, how much plastic they eat. Do they metabolize the plastic? Can this actually be used in plastic remediation?
Remediation meaning don't let the plastic sit in a landfill for 200 years. Like, are these worms the solution?
Okay, so yeah, that is the enticing question. Brian experimented with it. He fed the worms a diet of polyethylene. That's the world's most commonly manufactured form of plastic. Usually polyethylene, to your point, takes decades or even centuries to decompose. But Brian found...
it takes about 2,000 or so waxworms to fully consume a plastic bag in about 24 hours. And then we went into, well, how's that being done? So we looked at the bacteria, and we were able to isolate plastic-degrading bacteria from their guts.
So his preliminary results suggest that the worms break down the plastic into like fatty acids. They metabolize it into energy, and whatever's left over gets stored as fat.
There's just one problem.
No, what's the problem?
When you feed them just on plastic, they die, usually within a few days. So that's not good.
No, that's not good.
Yeah, it's not a renewable recycling right. system, it seems.
Yeah, so Brian and his team figured out if you feed these worms a supplemented diet, like you throw in some carbs, some protein along with the plastic, that could help the waxworms live like longer, healthier lives. And he presented his research this week at the Society for Experimental Biology annual conference in Belgium.
So what's the next step? Do I get to feed my plastic bags to worms?
Well, one cool possibility, scientists are working on a way to isolate these worms' saliva and gut bacteria so they can just use the enzymes produced by these worms to directly break down plastics. Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, continuing with our critter theme, the third story is about animals that live at high altitudes. How high are we talking?
Yeah, we're talking about animals that live 1,000 meters above sea level, so higher than 3,000 feet. You can picture Table Mountain in South Africa or Mount Diablo in California.
Yeah, all kinds of animals have adapted to live at this altitude or higher. Think like bighorn sheep, alpaca, Andean guinea pigs. Where they live, there, as you probably know, there are fewer air molecules.
Right. You hike up a mountain and you get out of breath because of the low oxygen.
Right. The air is thinner, drier. So Ali Graham, a biologist at the University of Kansas, wanted to know how these conditions impacted the animal's evolution. And she pursued this question by looking at genetic open source data.
I wanted to let, like I said, the data tell me what the story was rather than me like trying to, have any control over that.
She essentially screened the genomes of 27 different high altitude species and compared them to their low altitude relatives. So she compared rabbits that live at low altitude with pika that live at high altitude. These two lineages diverged several million years ago.
And Ali did see a pattern. She and her team published their findings in the journal Current Biology this month.
Okay, so drum roll, what did she find? What's the pattern?
Yeah, she saw like a big reduction in genes related to smell. Like nearly a quarter of these species' smell receptor genes were turned off. And Ali also saw a reduction in the part of the brain associated with smell.
Maybe because it was better to invest genetic resources in taste or vision, though far more work is needed to be done to determine what ultimately drove this evolutionary mechanism.
Yeah, that is not what I expected you to say. Fewer smell receptors? Yeah. Would the same be true for humans at high altitudes?
So interestingly, no. Like researchers compared the genomes of Tibetans who traditionally have lived at high altitudes with Han Chinese people who traditionally live at like lower altitudes, and looking at just their genetics found like no olfactory changes. None of these like gene differences.
Yeah, Ali suspects it's because these groups haven't been separated long enough for a genetic signature related to smell to pop up.
But at the same time, I like half joke, like, well, we'll check back in a couple million years and see whether or not that signal has popped up in human populations, right?
And if it has, we'll report on it.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, Zach Chevron, a biologist at the University of Montana who was not a part of the study, says a nice follow-up would be to go into the mountains and test the nose power of these animals directly.
Field work you can smell. I love it. That is Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave. Subscribe now for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thank you both.
Thank you, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
House Republicans narrowly passed a more than 900-page bill containing tax cuts, increased border security, and slashing safety net programs such as SNAP. Even though Republicans had a tough time getting it through Congress, it might be an even tougher sell to the American people.
It is absolutely upside down. More people dislike it than like it.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hemming, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Lake Bemidji State Park has limited access. The campground, beach, and most trails south of Birchmont Beach Road are open. All other trails and the fishing pier remain closed until further notice. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contests, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some tribal nations are among the most remote communities in the country, and the rural health care shortage has hit them especially hard. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports that one tribe in Nevada has found a solution, a doctor's office on wheels.
It's a clear morning in Lovelock, Nevada, a small desert town about 90 miles northeast of Reno. It's also home to the Lovelock Paiute tribe, which has a 20-acre reservation on the edge of town. I'm at a tree-shaded park where the tribe is hosting its annual health fair. There's live music, jewelry vendors, information booths, and food trucks. There's also a vehicle that looks like a large blue and white motorhome, idling on the edge of the park. But inside are two patient rooms and a center lab with a blood draw station. It's a mobile health clinic brought here by the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe, located about an hour away. Gabriel Bourne just stepped out of the vehicle.
Having access to this, I was able to get some shots I needed, and you know that I should have probably had a long time ago, but didn't get.
Time and travel are the biggest barriers, he says. Bourne's a Fallon Paiute Shoshone member, but he lives in Lovelock, so seeing a physician in Fallon is a two-hour round trip. So when Bourne, who hadn't been to the doctor in more than a year, realized he was steps away from a mobile clinic, he took full advantage.
I'm able to get my eye appointment, which I've needed glasses for a while, along with some cancer screening setups and follow-up with the doctor to see labs and everything else.
Accessing quality health care has long been an issue for tribal nations, especially in rural areas. The Federal Indian Health Service has less than 100 hospitals and medical clinics nationwide, all to serve about 2.8 million American Indians and Alaska Natives. And most facilities suffer chronic staffing shortages. Some of the highest vacancy rates have been felt by the Navajo Nation, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Phoenix, Arizona, and Billings, Montana. John Pichon is the director of the Fallon Tribal Health Center, which runs the mobile clinic here at this fair. He says the lack of access was amplified 5 years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic.
A lot of healthcare facilities were being shut down, and with all the services being closed, we needed something to go out to the communities.
For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
The Yurok tribe in rural Northern California is catching up to the digital age. Like many tribal communities that are located in remote regions, the Yurok Nation has gone without high-speed broadband internet, but that's changing. Christina Onnested reports.
Where I grew up, there wasn't any power and phone lines, no connectivity at all.
Shannon Holbert is board president of Ytel, Yurok Telecommunications, the first-time provider of broadband internet on the Yurok Reservation and surrounding communities in Northern California's Redwood region. She says the multi-million dollar project will create more than 200 jobs and make a world of difference.
This creates a reason for people to move back to the reservation because they have that ability to have access to connectivity and be able to have jobs anywhere that they can work remotely from the reservation and still be part of, you know, their everyday reservation activities and communities and all of those things. Students are going to be able to have access to online collaboration tools.
A Census Bureau report last year found Native American communities lag behind the rest of the nation in broadband connectivity. 90% of U.S. households have access, compared to 70% of Native communities. Hulbert says it's largely because Native American reservations are remote in rural areas where there remains a digital divide. The Whitetail Broadband Project was made possible through federal and state grants. Christina Onnestad, National Native News, California.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Arctic Encounter Symposium, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Nanaimo Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global conversation at arcticencounter.com.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
He and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Decades of progress made on preventing and treating HIV/AIDS could be reversed by major funding cuts. That warning comes from the United Nations, which issued a new report today. It comes about 5 months after the U.S. halted much of its global HIV funding almost overnight. Africa is the region with the biggest population of people living with HIV and stands to see the most immediate impact. But experts say the fallout will be global, as Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg explains.
The U.S. was the biggest global donor towards HIV treatment and prevention under the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Since the start of the epidemic, almost 27 million deaths have been averted through treatment, UNAIDS says.
The sudden withdrawal of the single biggest HIV donor is putting this progress at risk.
That's UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Bianima speaking at the launch of the report in Johannesburg on Thursday.
If the world doesn't plug this hole, we estimate that an additional 6 million people will be newly infected in the next 4 years. We could have 4 million additional AIDS-related deaths.
In South Africa, which has one of the largest numbers of people living with HIV in the world, huge strides have been made, with most infected people now on antiretroviral drugs. The country's health minister, Aaron Mazzoletti, called the U.S. cuts a, quote, wake-up call.
This type of relationship where we depend on one country, and when the country is in some negative moods, the whole world collapses. Yes, it's scary.
Mazzoletti stressed an end to the epidemic could be near, but it requires access to new preventative drugs. South African scientists have been among the foremost researchers of HIV, participating in groundbreaking studies that benefit the international community. They were also major contributors to global research during the COVID-19 pandemic. But many clinical trials have now been stopped midway. Helen Rees, director of research institute WITS RHI in Johannesburg, said this is not only a blow for Africa.
The research that's been done for HIV, for TB in South Africa has had not only an impact for the country, but huge global impact as well.
Rees is this year's winner of a major World Health Organization award for, quote, outstanding contribution to public health. Still, her institute is facing major U.S. funding cuts. President Trump has said the U.S. is moving away from a focus on aid to trade in its relations with Africa. The withdrawal of U.S. support in January means UNAIDS has lost close to 50% of its funding, according to the organization's head, Bianima, with no time to plan for the shortfall.
As long as it festers in some parts of the world, it will come back to hit everybody else. This is not charity. This is solving a global problem together.
In the months since Trump's announcement, NPR has been speaking to ordinary South Africans affected. In Cape Town, I spoke to Nombeko Mpongo, a community AIDS activist who got the virus after being gang raped. I asked her how she felt when she first heard about the US cuts.
I remember for a few days, I felt suffocated. For me, it was like a volcano came and took everything away. And for me, it felt like a death penalty.
But after the initial shock, she rallied.
I realized, let me fight. Let me reach out to the communities because hope is what is going to carry us through.
She says Africans have fought this disease before and they'll do it again. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Foreign-born workers, including those without legal status, are vital to the U.S. economy, but ICE crackdowns are making some fear showing up for work. Our colleagues over at The Indicator, Darian Woods and Adrian Ma, wanted to know just how widespread these absences are.
When you bite into your summer cherries, they might have been picked by Gloria. She's a cherry picker in Washington State.
We start at 6 in the morning, we leave at midnight, 1 in the morning. The truth is, it's very tiring, and we leave with heavy feet. But we keep going for a good future and to keep being here, paying our bills and our taxes.
But like 1 in 3 crop pickers, she doesn't have legal status or work authorization. Lately, Gloria's been skipping a few shifts.
We don't go in because we see that immigration is there at the work sites.
In late May, the Trump administration ordered Immigration and Customs Enforcement to ramp up arrests. Around 1,200 people were being arrested each day in June, more than triple the number under Biden.
Many places are being left without workers, and the fruit is going to waste out of fear, not because people don't want to work.
From California to Texas, we've heard reports of sparse orchards and vegetables rotting in the fields as foreign-born workers dodge federal agents. We wanted to know about other industries, too. Large shares of immigrants also work in construction.
Brian Termail is a spokesperson for the Associated General Contractors of America.
The overwhelming response that we're getting is that there's a lot of anxiety among the workforce.
As of yet, though, those workers by and large keep coming to their construction sites. And what about another big industry for immigrants? Long-term care for elderly and disabled people. 1 in 3 long-term care workers are immigrants. Arnulfo de la Cruz represents long-term care workers in California. He's president of the union SEIU 2015.
Arnulfo has heard about immigration agents from his members.
We've had reports that there's been enforcement actions at nursing homes and skilled care facilities.
Now, on the whole, the workers he represents are still showing up for work. But he says there's one action that could have a big impact on the long-term care workforce. The Trump administration is ending temporary protected status for people from countries like Venezuela, Honduras, and Nicaragua. So a lot of workers will be required to leave the country soon unless they find another legal pathway.
Arnulfo recalls a worker from El Salvador who has temporary protected status, and she's extremely worried. El Salvador's status is scheduled to end next year.
It's funny because one of the first things she mentioned is who's going to care for the people that I'm caring for, right?
We reached out to the Department of Homeland Security to ask whether its leadership was concerned by worker absences. And we got a response from Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin. Quote, let's be clear. If there was any correlation between rampant illegal immigration and a good economy, Biden would have had a booming economy.
We actually checked the numbers, by the way, and the economy grew more under Joe Biden than the first Donald Trump administration, even when he controlled for price and population growth.
The policy mega bill that became law last week, that will triple the detention budget for immigration and customs enforcement. It'll also likely mean funding for thousands more immigration agents to accelerate deportations.
Darian Woods,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted jazz on America Avenue. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market. Open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, how you can help residents of northern Minnesota impacted by the recent storms. Then, why a graduate of McAllister College is suing the school. And a new outdoor concert venue is coming to the Twin Cities. I'm Chantel Sings. Residents in and around the Bemidji area are still dealing with the aftermath of a major storm that left a path of destruction behind. The National Weather Service says the storm in late June brought wind gusts between 100 and 120 miles per hour. That's the equivalent of between a Category 2 and a Category 3 hurricane. Emergency managers want to remind those still repairing the damage to get multiple estimates from reputable contractors and make sure they're insured and licensed with the City of Bemidji. Listeners who want to help storm victims should contact the United Way of Bemidji. Ahead, an alumnus of McAllister College in St. Paul recently sued the private college for unethical use of rats in their psychology labs. Reporter Kylie Kendall has all the details of the lawsuit.
An alumnus of McAllister College is suing the school to try and stop them from using live rats for psychology experiments. Dr. Neil Barnard graduated from McAllister in 1975 with a degree in psychology. While planning for his class reunion, he discovered the school was still conducting what he called unnecessary and cruel animal experiments.
Ones that I had been involved in 50 years ago, and that had been invented probably 50 years before that. They were still ongoing.
But the problem wasn't just that these methods were still being used.
Most disturbingly, that the college was being less than honest about it. It publicly says that they use the highest ethical standards.
Those standards prohibit using animals if there's an alternative. Barnard says there are plenty of other options. Barnard accuses the institution of using Skinner boxes. When asked for a response, McAllister said in a written statement that they do use conditioning chambers, but not specifically Skinner boxes, since Skinner boxes imply use of electrical shocks. Barnard said the method is still outdated.
I've heard from psychologists, I've heard from veterinarians, I've heard from people who have said, I can't believe this is still happening in this day and age.
Barnard spoke to a former classmate and was shocked to find out what was happening 50 years ago was still happening today.
He said, you guys don't know what goes on here. And he said, first of all, to make them perform, I have to starve them. They have to be really hungry or really thirsty, because otherwise they're not going to perform for you.
And it doesn't stop there.
I take each one, throw them in a trash can, one on top of the other, alive, on top of the other, and then I pour chloroform over the top and I close the lid.
After current psychology students confirmed to Barnard these practices are still used, he eventually spoke with the college president about the issue and was hopeful.
Then out of the blue, I got a message from her saying, we have no desire for any further contact or any discussion on this issue. If you have any other comments on it, please go to this attorney.
That's when Barnard knew he had to do something more.
I have to say, I thought, all right, let's make sure that you do deal with this. And so I'm bringing them to court.
With the help of Barnard's nonprofit, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, he put up two billboards around the college, along with a mobile billboard at his reunion, which he did not attend.
Saying basically, Stanford and Yale and Penn don't do this. Mac, when are you going to get with it?
When asked for a comment on the story, McAllister provided us with a statement that said the college adheres to all ethical standards and that their programs do use a small number of rats and mice, but are overseen by an animal ethics committee. They do not allow external parties to interfere with or dictate their curriculum. But Barnard said he has not heard from them yet.
I have seen nothing from the college on this at all. So a court date will be set and will be heard.
Barnard is requesting the college return his $100 donation, a declaration that the college violated the law, and for the school to stop using animals in the labs, or if they continue to use them, to take down the statement saying they adhere to the highest ethical standards.
I just hope for the animals and for the students, and frankly for good science. I hope we win soon.
This is Kylie Kendall for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. An outdoor music venue is set to come to North Minneapolis right along the Mississippi River. That's thanks to a $12.5 million grant from the state. It's part of a larger redevelopment plan that includes a new park, housing, and a performing arts center in the coming years. Some Northside residents and advocates have expressed ongoing concern. They question who the amphitheater will benefit. The city, however, has published a detailed racial equity analysis. The venue's construction timeline has yet to be announced.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Catholic Church has a new Mass. It was originally planned by Pope Francis. It uses prayers and readings inspired by the late Pope's writings on climate change. His successor, Pope Leo XIV, celebrated the Mass for the first time on Wednesday. And like Francis, Leo called on Catholics to recognize the urgency of protecting the environment. Claire Jean Gravet from Religion News Service has the story.
Wearing bright green vestments, Pope Leo celebrated a special new Mass centered on care for the environment. It was a private Mass for Vatican staff in the lush gardens of the papal summer residence, Castel Gandolfo, which Leo called a natural cathedral. In his homily during the Mass, Leo reminded Catholics of their religious imperative to care for creation.
We hear the cry of the earth. We hear the cry of the poor. Because this cry has reached the heart of God. Our indignation is His indignation. Our work is His work.
In his first months as Pope, Leo has signaled that creation care will be a particular focus of his papacy, much as it was for Francis. The new Mass is called Pro Custodia Creationis, Latin meaning for the care of creation. It's now part of a collection of 17 special Masses for social issues. The Mass begins by describing the awe-inspiring beauty of the earth, and the scripture, read during the Mass, emphasizes the theme that God cares for creation, and humans should too. Leo said, quote, "We see so many natural disasters in the world, nearly every day and in so many countries, that are in part caused by the excesses of being human with our lifestyle." Cardinal Michael Cerny is the head of the Vatican office that created the Mass.
This Mass is a reason for joy. It calls us to be faithful stewards of what God has entrusted to us, not only in daily choices and public policies, but also in our way of living in the world.
Pope Leo will be spending several weeks in July at the summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, a hilltop town overlooking Lake Albano, about an hour south of Rome, where he will continue to lead the church and maybe even make use of the paddle court. For NPR News, I'm Claire Giangrave in Rome.
And the story was produced in collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service.
There is a new Superman in theaters this weekend, and though you might be thinking more Superman, this latest version feels a little different. Among other things, it features a very cute dog.
Crypto. Home. David, home.
We here at NPR are lucky to have a veritable Superman expert on staff. He even wrote a book on the guy. It's Glenn Weldon, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Scott, what's this veritable nonsense? I spent years researching that book.
Listen, I cannot stress to you how anxious I am to ask this first question, because I feel like for nearly 20 years now, I have eagerly anticipated new Superman movies. I have gone to the theater. It's been like Charlie Brown and Lucy and the football, and I've been horribly disappointed. So, okay, Glenn, how is the new Superman movie?
All right, I'm going to put it this way. All I want out of a Superman movie is, you know, make me cheer. That's it. Make me feel that kind of a welling up of joy and excitement. That's something I see on screen. Because when you're in a crowded theater, you know this, and everyone goes nuts around you. That's a great feeling. And that is exactly what's been missing from superhero movies for a very long time. Because Hollywood tried to make them, I don't know, more adult and nuanced, which always translates to dark and gloomy.
Which is not Superman.
It's not Superman. And I am here to tell you, Scott, you're going to cheer. You're going to find yourself swept up in excitement several times in this movie. Now, to be fair, you're not always going to be cheering Superman. Sometimes you're going to be cheering other characters. Mostly, though, you're going to be cheering for the dog.
Okay, so this is Crypto, the super dog we were talking about. Crypto with a K. He is a superpowered dog in a red cape. You know, he's been in the comic books for a while, but I think, like, he's not really movie-level pop culture known. Tell us about Crypto and why he is in this movie.
Well, I mean, when I was writing my book about Superman over the years, I came to love Crypto. This is a dog that debuted in the comics back in the 50s during what we call the Silver Age of comics, which is when things got goofy, because that was a time when comics creators realized that the comic book page doesn't have a special effects budget. He can do anything. I never thought I'd see Crypto of all things on screen, but here we are, and he's fantastic.
That is great. You wrote in a review that we published on NPR.org this morning that the new Superman movie is, in your words, I'm going to read them to you, corny, hokey, cheesy, achingly sincere, cringe even. I don't know, like, maybe that's not an insult when we're talking about the Man of Steel, right?
Yeah, you get it. I mean, Superman is corny. He has to be to work. And I was very worried when they tapped writer director James Gunn for this. He did the Guardians of the Galaxy movies for Marvel. I didn't think he was the right guy for this character because his trademark in the past has been kind of glib and snarky. And snarky is kryptonite. You get snarky anywhere near Superman and he dies. But you can tell right away that Gunn gets it because, you know, so David Corenswet plays Superman in this movie. Film opens. He's just had his big red butt handed to him in a fight. The very first word we see him say on screen is golly. And Scott, when that happened, I let out a sigh of relief. My shoulders dropped. I'm like, we're in good hands because Superman isn't cool. He's an ideal. He represents the best we can aspire to be. And that's why this movie could not have come at a better time.
You say in your review that every era gets the Superman it needs. Why'd you say that?
Well, when I was a kid, the 78 Christopher Reeve Superman movie came out just as Vietnam and Watergate had us all feeling, you know, justifiably cynical, I would say. And that movie gave us something, someone to believe in again. Gunn's Superman arrives at another time in American history when everything that we stand for, right, bedrock American principles like justice for all and defending the defenseless and helping those in need, those feel farther away than they should right now. And you watch this movie and you're reminded what those ideals look like, even if they're packaged in, you know, bold primary colors and little red boots. But at the end of the day, what is Superman for? He is there to represent the idea that if you're gifted with power and privileged, an indestructible body, in his case, right, you could choose to do anything. What he chooses to do, the only thing he chooses to do, is to be of service to others, to take action, to place that indestructible body in harm's way between innocent people and anyone who wants to hurt them. That is goofy, that is corny, that is hokey, but it is also something that superhero movies haven't been for a very long time. It is legitimately inspiring.
That is Glenn Weldon, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thank you for the news you brought me, and thank you. Thank you for doing this conversation.
Take me home, Crypto.
It's a bird. It's a plane. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Walker Bay Theater presents a tribute to Patsy Cline July 10th through the 13th. Find showtimes and more information at walkerbaytheater.org. And taking a look at the weather tonight, increasing clouds, temps in the low to mid-60s, chance for showers and thunderstorms after midnight. Friday, good chance for showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, areas of smoke possible, highs 81 to 83, and Saturday, mostly sunny with a slight chance of rain, highs in the mid to upper 70s.
Could it have saved lives? Absolutely, yes, it could.